Well, good afternoon. Suddenly it feels like Sesshin is slipping away from us. It seemed so long, just a day or so ago. Strange how that works. And now, whew, already there are thoughts of other worlds and other things that keep impressing themselves on us. We have very busy lives. But as Coben said, as I said in the first talk, that when we sit Sesshin, everything is gathered together as we sit. And now we begin to experience that. The past flows up through us, some extremely vivid questions that perhaps we thought were answered come up again with a new flavor. And the future rises up with all the questions that it contains. What next? What next? At the same time, we become much, much more aware of our surroundings. It's kind of amazing how beautiful everything begins to seem. I remember once when we gathered for tea like this, and they passed around a bowl full of strawberries. And somebody looked at the strawberries and burst into tears because they were so beautiful. We're struck by how things truly are, rather than whizzing by and missing most of it. Part of that is due to the sort of mystery of mindfulness. This is my own take on mindfulness. That in order to be truly mindful, we disappear. Sometimes people get confused. I know I met someone who was very confused. She said, my mind is just so full of everything that I'm seeing and hearing, and I just can't keep track of everything, and I'm just going and going all. And she was trying so hard to be herself and be what she was experiencing at the same time. Mindfulness is about the experience. And so when we go outside and feel the air on us, we from Zazen, we can stand up and just experience the feeling of the air without having to bring ourselves into focus. It's me experiencing the air and the beauty of the trees. Artists, musicians, poets create in that way. If an artist sits down and says, now I'm going to paint this beautiful thing, that I'm gets in the way, terribly in the way. You have to be completely involved and, in a sense, gone from the scene in order to truly express it, to become it. It's true of how we meet each other. It's true of how we know. And And it's not some fancy experience. It's very simple. And it's what practice enlightenment means. That our practice is enlightenment. And enlightenment is our practice. Practice itself is the enacting of Buddha, the truth of form and emptiness. If we live one side or the other side, we get lost. If we are cultivating entirely the form side and ignoring the emptiness side, it becomes a very kind of harsh it can be very intense kind of life, and also very difficult because it feels so solitary. It feels like it's just me doing it. And if we live on the other side, if we emphasize and cultivate entirely the emptiness side, we become, Chogyam Trungpa said, we become blind and deaf. He said, we can't live like that or we'll be run over by a truck in a minute. It's dangerous. So how we manage this middle way is this practice enlightenment. Body, mind, self, other, in which we rise and meet, come and go. And in the midst of it, we are living a fairly ordinary life. We aren't monks and nuns. Although often many of us long to be that. Often people would go to Koban and say, I need to shave my head and throw everything away and just go. And I know once he said, you'll go to hell. And he went, and he did. So, it's a problem for us, really. And it's not just us. It's our whole world problem. We can see our life in the world and all lives in the world as ways of trying to work this out, of how to be this. Both sides, and fulfill and express with our whole life in a way that does no harm to others and that creates a safe field in which each person can fulfill the promise that they came here to be. Our selfness very much gets in the way of that. Our animal nature gets very much in the way of it because we are afraid. We're afraid of to die, and rightly, because we will die and we don't know when. And we're afraid of each other, because we've had experiences where our trust was betrayed And so we don't know how to trust. And so we hold ourself in a shape and hold it close so we won't be hurt anymore. But as a result, the world is full of billions of people who are holding their self close, trying to be safe and never feeling safe. Never free enough to experience both sides. Never free enough to be blind and deaf. To drop the self. I'm reading a very interesting book that Donna Lynn left for me. She almost always leaves me a book for Sesshin, which is really mean. And it's always really interesting. This one is about, it's written by an ethnologist, and it's about Japanese women's development and practice of forms as healing. That form itself can be a healing way to be in the world. And what she means initially by form is how the shoes are left outside the door, how the carrots are cut in the kitchen, when the children are fed and put to bed, all the small domestic things that happen for which someone is responsible. And that in a Buddhist perspective, and these are all Soto Zen practicers who practice with Ayuma Roshi in Nagoya. They're lay practicers, but very serious. And they have taken up Buddhist practice at home. The forms they speak of are not the forms that we're concerned about here. And they're not rigid forms. They don't even sometimes think about them as forms, though the ethnologist does. And she's an American, a Japanese American, so her perspective is two-sided. And so she's always asking questions that they don't even know how to answer because they don't understand. They don't know what ritual means, for instance, although they are practicing ritual continually. Each person has a household altar and certain chants that are done at the household altar. They each have ways of healing herself and her family. And by healing, they mean finding compassion in themselves. Some kind of practice that helps them develop compassion. Very beautiful. So it's led me to think about our practice here and our tradition with Koban, which is so not usual. How we don't we don't follow the forms in such a strict way because we can't. I think that was very clear to Koban. He went to Zen Center to take all his Aheji knowledge, which is vast, and told them everything, how to do everything. There are many, many books filled with writing, full of how to do all this, all the forms. How to do Shuso ceremony, how to do the mountain seat ceremony and the going down the mountain and all those things. Here and at Hokoji, he encouraged us to help him develop the most simple forms and to not take form so seriously. Because each time we come together, we're new. It's a new set of us. And although some of us come over and over again, a lot of us don't. And so each time we begin to assemble and accommodate and work out together how we're going to eat and sleep, how we're going to make our way around the zendo in a comfortable way that doesn't bump into somebody else. Everything that we do that we call form is to make sesshin work smoothly. And of course, what happens is it doesn't work very smoothly at all, because we are starting from scratch basically every time. We, over the years, have rather wonderfully, I think, developed some forms that have been helpful. Not in the kind of way that we have to do it this way, but that it helps us to know that there's this way we've all agreed to do it. So that when we come, we're the host. Whoever is the host makes the rules, really. And then everyone is free to follow them. As I said the other day, then it feels really weird to go someplace else and they're doing it all wrong. You know, because it's not our way. But our way is not the best way. It's just the best way for the moment. And it isn't that we need to do it perfectly. We need to do it with sincerity and with a good spirit, with real meaning. And I know how different we all are about this. This is an incredibly fraught subject in every sangha. When I first got involved with Zen, I always said, I don't care about form. It embarrasses me. I get really, really embarrassed just standing and chanting. It just makes me feel really creepy. And I just let that be for a long time. And it took ages to begin to realize. And I realized it first with the prostrations. I began to realize that there was something there that I could feel. And then I began to get it in other ways as well. And I began to realize how little Koban had taught us about form. And I began to think, well, you know, if there are all these forms, then I had jolly well better know what they are. And so when Blanche Hartman invited me to go with her and a bunch of Bay Area women to Suzuki Roshi's place in Japan, in Yaizu, I went. And I thought, now I'm going to get it. Now I'll know how. And it was fabulous because they have a big thunder drum and they have a wonderful fish drum. Beautiful fish drum and thing, tock, 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 bam, bam. And we learned all of those things as best we could. But one of the first experiences we had, and I tell this often because it was such a surprise to me, is that when they were teaching us the forms of the service, Suzuki Roshi, this is young Suzuki Roshi, the son, Hoitz, and a monk he had assisting him, and Blanche Hartman, stood on the altar and argued with each other about how to do everything. It was serious argument. Well, we should. They had this beautiful big brass bell. You know, how do you do the bell? Well, you do it this way. No. We do it so Gigi like this, you know, or some other way. And they had spent a long time finding agreement on what they were going to ask us to do. And actually, during the whole month we were there, we never really did get a clear picture because so Gigi, Ahaji, and Tassajara, where Blanche trained, all had different forms. And they were all beautiful forms. And so we got little bits of them, and I came back feeling that Coben was absolutely right. He had told me when I asked him, someone asked me to do a wedding, and I went to Coben and I said, "What shall I do?" And he said, "Make it up." And I was appalled. But having come back from that experience and been very moved by it, by the presence of the Soto tradition there, of visiting Ahaji again. We just went overnight that time, but I had been there before for a week. And it's like going to Rome. It's huge, and everything is huge. The Mokugyo is as big as this whole piece of room. And to the small ones, the little nunnery in Nagoya, places where people were sincerely practicing. And they all had different forms. But they all were transmitting the Dharma in some way. And so I came back feeling that Jikoji itself can do this according to who is here, which is really what it's all about. It's about who comes. Form is very natural, I think. I used to think it was unnatural. It was imposing some kind of thing on just ordinary people, and how come we're doing this fancy thing when it's not a fancy thing at all. But then I began sitting up in Willits, where Steve felt that very way. You know, we don't need anything in this endo, just zafus only. So everybody sat, and I went up every month or so. And each time I went back, there was something new in the zendo. First, there was just a little table. And then there was a candle on it. And then a flower. And then a rock. You know, that was as far as they got to the Buddha. But and that itself was so interesting to me. I didn't say anything. And then they asked me about the Heart Sutra. And could we chant the Heart Sutra? And so this little country bohunk town up in Mendocino County, all by themselves, and it was mostly an AA program that turned into a little sangha. And they turned themselves into a little sangha, all by themselves. Very interesting. We don't know how this practice is going to develop. We have no idea. Coben said he hoped Jikoji would last at least 500 years, and that's my hope. And it's certainly, there's lots of ferment going on, even just in the Soto Zen tradition in America. Teachers are talking about creating standards, which will be very useful in many ways, and will be a hindrance in other ways, and something that is going to have to be worked out through generations, I do believe. But in the meantime, we get to decide, based on the tradition that has come to us. And part of our tradition is the Kodo Sawaki lineage. Koban practiced there. He never became a part of that sangha. He just dropped in for sesshin when he was at university. And Uchiyama Roshi tried to persuade him to come and stay and be a monk there, and Koban stuck it out at school instead and got his degree. Kodo Sawaki was a very magnetic, charismatic character. This picture is up in the community room. People flocked to sit with him. And Uchiyama Roshi, by his own description, was a big, slow, quiet person who was probably even more shy at the altar than I ever was. And when Kodo Sawaki Roshi asked him to take over on Taiji, Uchiyama Roshi said, "Oh, I can't do it. I just hate all that ceremony and all that stuff going on." And Kodo Roshi said, "Then don't do it. Just don't do it." So that started a new tradition, which is being continued now in Japan and now in Bloomington, Indiana as well. Extremely intense practice. Peter, you've done it, haven't you?
One sesshin.
One sesshin. And lived to tell the tale. But it's no service, no chanting, no service, no, just sitting. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And hardly any sleep, as I understand.
We sleep not as much as usual here, but we do. But over there, in Bloomington, they sleep from 9 to 4.
I guess that's right. Yeah, he gets up real early.
Yeah, you're on the bench by 2:30.
Yeah. Recently, they've at Bloomington even done one of the karaoke meals. It's just all buffet.
Oh, really?
During sesshin, during the informal ritual, or during Genzoe and whatnot.
Interesting. It's one more distraction. Yeah, I guess so. Well, that's the thing. You know, the forms are a mindfulness practice, all of them. They're like the path going in a Japanese garden, which I always thought was really weird, how you had to, you were about to fall all the time because they were just these slippery rocks that you had to follow. And yet, of course, once you realize what it's about, it's to keep you awake, to really be there. You have to be there or you're going to fall down. And Oryoki is the same. Ringing the bells is the same. Doing the han is the same. All of those things are keeping us awake. And they're extremely helpful. If we, meaning us sort of lay practicers at Jikoji and various other many places, because we come from so far away, so many of us, want to become really expert in the forms, then there are lots of places to go. San Francisco Zen Center is wonderful. and Berkeley Zen Center and Los Angeles. There are many, many places. Daibo Satsu.
Santa Cruz right down the road.
Kokyo and Shuho are doing a great job down there. So, we have choices. But our choice here is to continue Kobun's way and provide another kind of flavor to the Dharma. When I think about the origin of ritual, I think about children, young children, and how, as a very young child, like 1.5 and 2, they will pick up one thing, like a stone or a leaf, and just truly be with that. Or a little older children create a secret place for themselves, and sometimes collect beautiful stones and leaves and things, and make a kind of altar, even though there's no name for it for them. Some place to be in the world that's what we might call holy, that brings up another kind of mind. And it's not strict. It's not required. It's not particular except to that one child. And I think what we're doing has some quality like that. Not that we're totally individualistic, because that's a big mistake. That doesn't work in Sangha at all. But how we work together to create forms that serve us. Not too much, not too many, not too strict, not too fancy. And learn them. Donna Lynn put together a beautiful book. Really fantastic book of everything that we ever learned about form through the years at Floating Zendo. And it's not like you will find at Zen Center at all. It's our own version. And it's only just that we've all agreed to it. And we can change our minds and rewrite the whole thing if we want to do that. There's freedom in that. I found a very interesting thing has happened in the last few years. When I first began to practice, Kobun was used very much by Zen Center, because after Suzuki Roshi died, he left Kobun with a promise. Kobun promised that he would finish the job of teaching the forms to everyone. And so he spent a lot of his time. We felt it was our time, you know, writing on the back of Rakusus for Richard Baker Roshi. So, now I've lost my train of thought. Yes, that he would finish teaching all the forms, but he came here and especially only taught us the forms he thought we needed. So he taught Orioki right away, and he taught, and by example, he taught chanting. He had a fabulous chanting voice. And the service, we had very simple, very short service with just the Heart Sutra, but we did it both in English and in Chinese. Maybe you did that in Santa Cruz too?
Sino-Japanese. Sino meaning Chinese. Yeah. Yeah. And that's it, right? Yeah. And Kinhin and Zazen. But for all those things, he was very, very clear. And I think he was very curious about us and not at all understanding us, but respecting us. And he said, I don't want to make you Japanese. I don't want you to be square bamboo. Do you know how that you make square bamboo? Yeah, I just make a little square box and plant a baby bamboo in there and it comes up square. So we have this really interesting situation that we're in. And as a place, this is, Jikoji is the host. And so the host creates the forms, and then we all do our best and discover how hard it is, even when it's really, really simple, and how many mistakes we make, and how exasperating it is when somebody else makes mistakes, when we know what's the right way. So it's a wonderful practice for us as far as just developing our ability to accept wider and wider and more magnanimously what's going on in the world. In this world, but also in the world. So I think that's what my message was. I'm sure there's some discussion, some question.
I worry about such things.
Yes.
Sort of forgotten that. But even Korean has its own flavor.
Oh, yeah.
In the summer now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're all different.
And as the years go by, they'll be more different. Yeah. And yet the same, because the foundation is the same. The foundational understanding is the same. And that's the falling off the cliff or something. Yeah.
I wanted to add one more comment on your earliest comments. There was a recent book review by a guy named Jim Holt called Two Minds Running. It was basically that there's an experiential reality as well as a recorded reality.
Mm-hmm.
They line up very close to what actually happens,
yeah,
as contrasted with what the ego makes up and remembers and stores in its memory.
Yes.
And they're quite different. They're particularly different for optimistic versus depressive personalities. Optimistic tend to be sort of rose silver.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Depressive tend to be pretty realistic.
Yes. I can tell who you are.
A man named Hahnemann, who actually won the Nobel Prize for psychological research, who wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which essentially explores the difference of our experiential reality ongoing,
mm-hmm,
and how we react and how we behave, as opposed to the slower ego-mediated responses that are absolutely necessary. We're not going to kill ourselves.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I always use my journals as the example, my own personal example. I've kept them since I was 11. And when I want to check some fact, then I go back, and it's always, I don't remember it at all. What I wrote is what I wrote at the time. I don't remember it that way. It completely shifts and changes as time, even short times, go by. It's distressing in a way. We'd like to feel like we really know something, but it's very humbling and very interesting. Yeah. Beata?
Darlene used to talk about living from the body's point of view. Mm-hmm. And one of the main ways that she brought that forth was rhythm and ritual. She called it rhythm and ritual.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the body, you know, has a natural rhythm. It has a heartbeat. It likes to rock. You know, there are just certain rhythms that the body has, and she encouraged people with pain, especially, but everybody, she thought it was really for people to create a personal ritual that they did every day, just or to take a ritual they do every day, like brushing their teeth, and make it holy.
Yes.
Make it sacred. Bow before writing to something, whatever is meaningful to you. And that always is so moving to watch people do that and come back and how that opens something. So there is, I'm thinking about your kids and their little leaves and rocks. You know, it doesn't matter what's on the altar. It's about their relationship.
Yes.
And their interaction with it. It's really astounding to me. And I really brought that forth to your comments.
Yeah.
So there is a place for group sort of sangha rhythm, right? Or,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in a sense, that's what we're creating with form. So that we all move together, we all know what to do, right?
Yes, it all is. The sounds that we make and the way that we walk, it's all very rhythmic. And I even think Orioki is like a dance. You know, it's a dance with our hands rather than our feet, but it's exactly what we do. And because it's precise, there's a kind of beauty and pleasure in that, just in doing it. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think maybe that's why those people in Willits brought in their rock. You know, mm-hmm. Like it wouldn't matter what it was. Like the table appears, you know.
Yeah.
It's like that people need comfort.
Yes.
A certain ritual has a certain something.
You know, in Pureg, it's really interesting because it's created by Brother David Stendhal Rost and by Koban and Vanya. And because they needed Brother David to give a Catholic flavor to everything because it's Austria, they created the foyer with Meister Eckhart, big book of Meister Eckhart, and then a crucifix and incense to burn. And so when you go in as the doshi, you first go over to the crucifix and Meister Eckhart and offer the incense. Thank you very much. Good morning. And then you go to the next, on the other corner, and there's a Buddha and a little incense. And so you offer incense. Good morning. And then you go inside, and this beautiful altar, on which is a huge stone from the mountain. And it's perfect. Yeah. And then you offer incense, and bong, 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 and it starts the day. Yeah.
Where is
that? In Austria, Pureg. Yeah. Up in the snow. Jane?
Beata's comment reminded me, last year I spent some time at City Center and there was a discussion, a lot of discussion about ritual, class on it. And quite a lot of discussion about the difference between ritual and routine, because a lot of people have those things confused.
Yes. Yes, they do.
They say, well, you know, I have the same ritual every day. I get up, I drink my coffee, I make my lunch, I get in the car, I go to work. And it's like a lot of us, you know, who really enjoy ritual and what it embodies, we're like, no.
Well, that's,
you mentioned the relationship with whatever it is you're doing.
Yes.
That's what is the key, it's the relationship.
Yes.
I mean, people come in here and we're doing our little shtick, and for that, you know, for some people it'll be very routine. And so there's no wealth there for them.
That's right. That's right. It's very easy to develop a habit, an automatic habit. So you bow to the cushion, boink, like that, you know, and turn around, boink, and sit down. But if you really are relating to and participating fully, then you truly bow to your cushion every time. It takes that kind of attention, though. And it's what we hope to develop, and that's what the Japanese women were talking about, that if you truly develop that kind of relationship with whatever you do, that compassion arises, that it's compassion that you feel when you line your shoes up, it's compassion you feel when you feed a child. It's not just poking food in somebody's mouth. So, and that's healing for the person who's doing it. That's their way of healing themselves of their hurts and their wounds. So in that sense, it's invaluable. And it takes real practice to develop it and not turn it into habit. Coben said when he was at Aheiji in the beginning, he just, his first visit, he just was almost fainted. He was just so overcome by the atmosphere of it. He could just feel how intense it was. And then when he signed up and became a monk there, he didn't feel it at all anymore until he got called back to see his old master. And then when he returned, he could feel it again. So it doesn't have to be real special. Otherwise, that gets to be too much also. We don't have to cut each carrot in the kitchen with, I don't know, special blessing for each slice or something. You know? that's sort of a New Agey kind of woo-woo stuff. But just to be sincerely and fully holy where we are with everything that we're with, and not get too many issues involved with it. Just let it be what it is. This smile. Bhajan?
I just wanted to share another story with you about Colvin. Just prior to his passing, he was coming once a month and teaching me to Colvin. And the last time that he was here, we had a little circus, only like about 8 of us, mostly residents. And most of the people living here at that time were young and new to the practice, and kind of confused by all of this stuff that we've been doing. I said, Colby, maybe you could talk a little bit about this, about these forms. And he said, what are you doing? Well, you know, heart sleeper, prostration. Make it up fresh every day.
Yeah.
Some new person should make a poem, sing a song.
Yes.
Make it up every day, new.
Yes.
Okay. We tried that for about 2 weeks. some people can't even talk before they have a
very, yes. He said that to us about the precepts. He said you should write your own precepts. You should write your own sutra. He said we are waiting for an American sutra. Oh, thank you. I can see it.